So, welcome once again. And, yeah, it would seem that Sherlock Holmes was right. Whatever remains after you've stripped away all the chaff and bollocks is probably true. Did Sherlock Holmes say that? Well, something along those lines. And let me reassure you that this podcast is not sponsored by Pfizer, Moderna, Johnson & Johnson, AstraZeneca, or is it propped up by any donations from supranational government organisations such as the MHRA, the Office for National Statistics, or the JCV, whatever they're called. Anyway, that's enough acronyms and weird things. Should we try and carry on? Let's do it. I'm going to put my feet up here. And, yeah, it's all tickety-boo here on planet Magpie. If I can possibly select my Kindle, we will carry on with chapter 20. It's chapter 20 of Dracula, and this is a big old Kindle, this, so why don't we see if we can readjust it, and see if we can head off towards chapter 10 of Dracula, and why not? More letters. Letter, Dr. Seward, to the Honourable Arthur Holmwood. 6th of September. My dear Art, my news today is not so good. Lucy this morning had gone back a bit. There is, however, one good thing which has arisen from it. Mrs. Westenra was naturally anxious concerning Lucy, and has consulted me professionally about her. I took advantage of the opportunity and told her that my old master, Van Helsing, the great specialist, was coming to stay with me, and that I would put her in his charge conjointly with myself. So now we can come and go without alarming her unduly, for a shock to her would mean sudden death, and this, in Lucy's weak condition, might be disastrous to her. We are hedged in with difficulties, all of us, my poor fellow, but please God, we shall come through them all right. If any need, I shall write, so that if you do not hear from me, take it for granted that I am simply awaiting news. In haste, yours ever, John Seward. Dr. Seward's Diary. 7th of September. The first thing Van Helsing said to me when we met at Liverpool Street was, "Have you said anything to our young friend? To lover of her?" "No," I said, "I waited till I had seen you, as I said in my telegram. I wrote him a letter simply telling him that you were coming, as Miss Westenra was not so well, and that I should let him know if need be." Let me move the microphone in a little bit. "Right, my friend," he said, "quite right. Better he not know as yet. Perhaps he will never know, I pray so, but if it need..." "No, this is going well. I pray so, but if it be needed, then he shall know all. And my good friend John," that's how it really sounded, but I can't be bothered. "Let me caution you. You deal with the madman. All men are mad in some way or the other, and inasmuch as you deal discreetly with your madman, so deal with God's madman too, the rest of the world. You tell not your madman what you do, nor why you do it. You tell them not what you think. So you shall keep knowledge in its place, where it may rest, where it may gather its kind around it and breed. You and I shall keep as yet what we know here and here." He touched me on the heart and on the forehead, and then touched himself the same way. "I have for myself thoughts at the present. Later I shall unfold to you." "Why not now?" I asked. "It may do some good. We may arrive at some decision." He looked at me and said, "My friend John, when the corn is grown, even before it is ripened, while the milk of its mother earth is in him, and the sunshine has not yet begun to paint him with his gold, the husbandman, he pull the ear and rub him between his rough hands and blow away the green chaff and say to you, 'Look, he's good corn. He will make a good crop when the time comes.'" I did not see the application and told him so. For reply, he reached over and took my ear in his hand and pulled it playfully, as he used long ago to do at lectures, and said, "The good husbandman tell you so then because he knows, but not till then. But you do not find the good husbandman dig up his planted corn to see if he grow. That is for the children who play at husbandry, and not for those who take it as of the work of their life. See you now, friend John, I have sown my corn, and nature has her work to do in the making it sprout. If he sprout at all, there's some promise, and I wait till the ear begins to swell." He broke off, for he evidently saw that I understood. Then he went on gravely, "You were always a careful student, and your case-book was ever more full than the rest, and I trust that good habit have not failed. Remember, my friend, that knowledge is stronger than memory, and we should not trust the weaker. Even if you have not kept the good practice, let me tell you that this case of our dear miss is one that may be, mind, I say may be, of such interest to us and others that all the rest may not make him kick the beam, as your people say. Take, then, good note of it. Nothing is too small. I counsel you, put down in record even your doubts and surmises. Hereafter it may be of interest to you to see how true your guess. We learn from failure, not from success." When I described Lucy's symptoms the same as before, but infinitely more marked, he looked very grave, but said nothing. He took with him a bag in which there were many instruments and drugs, the ghastly paraphernalia of our beneficial trade, as he once called, in one of his lectures, the equipment of a professor of the healing craft. When we were shown in, Mrs. Westenra met us. She was alarmed, but not nearly so much as I expected to find her. Nature, in one of her beneficent moods, has ordained that even death has some antidote to its own terrors. Here, in a case where any shock may prove fatal, matters are so ordered that, from some cause or other, the thing's not personal. Even the terrible change in her daughter, to whom she is so attached, do not seem to reach her. It is something like the way Dame Nature gathers round a foreign body an envelope of some insensitive tissue which can protect from evil that which it would otherwise harm by contact. If this be an ordered selfishness, then we should pause before we condemn anyone for the vice of egoism. For there may be deeper root for its cause than we have knowledge of. I used my knowledge of this phase of spiritual pathology and set down a rule that she should not be present with Lucy, or think of her illness more than was absolutely required. She assented readily, so readily that I saw again the hand of nature fighting for life. Van Helsing and I were shown up to Lucy's room. If I was shocked when I saw her yesterday, I was horrified when I saw her today. She was ghastly, chalkily pale. The red seems to have gone even from her lips and gums, and the bones of her face stood out prominently. Her breathing was painful to see or hear. Van Helsing's face grew set as marble, and his eyebrows converged till they almost touched over his nose. Lucy lay motionless and did not seem to have strength to speak, so for a while we were all silent. Then Van Helsing beckoned to me and we went gently out of the room. The instant we had closed the door, he stepped quickly along the passage to the next door, which was open. Then he pulled me quickly in with him and closed the door. "My God," he said, "this is dreadful. There is not time to be lost. She will die for sheer want of blood to keep the heart's action as it should be. There must be a transfusion of blood at once. Is it you?" "Sorry, my mobile phone has gone off. Someone in Amsterdam." "It is a takeaway, much delayed. A kebab. 20 gilder. "Is it you or me?" "I suppose that kebab is lost now. It will never be delivered." "I'm younger and stronger, Professor. It must be me." "Then get ready at once." "I will bring up my bag. I am prepared." I went downstairs with him, and as we were going there was a knock at the hall door. When we reached the hall, the maid had just opened the door, and Arthur, that's Arthur Homewood, who I have a vague recollection is from North America somewhere, but could be wrong, and Arthur was stepping quickly in. He rushed up to me, saying in an eager whisper, "Jack, I was so anxious. I read between the lines of your letter and have been in an agony. The dad was better, so I ran down here to see for myself. Is not that gentleman Dr. Van Helsing? I'm so thankful to you, sir, for coming." When first the professor's eye had lit upon him, he had been angry at his interruption at such a time, but now, as he took in his stalwart proportions and recognised the strong young manhood which seemed to emanate from him, his eyes gleamed. Without a pause, he said to him as he held out his hand, "Sir, you have come in time. You are the lover of our dear miss. She is bad, very, very bad. Nay, my child, do not go like that." For he suddenly grew pale and sat down in a chair, almost fainting. "You are to help her. You can do more than any that live, and your courage is your best help." "What can I do?" said Arthur hoarsely. "Tell me, and I shall do it. My life is hers, and I would give the last drop of blood in my body for her." The professor has a strongly humorous side, and I could from old knowledge detect a trace of its origin in his answer. "My young sir, I do not ask so much as that, not the last. What shall I do?" There was fire in his eyes, and his open nostrils quivered with intent. Van Helsing slapped him on the shoulder. "Come," he said, "you are a man, and it is a man we want. You are better than me, better than my friend John." Arthur looked bewildered, and the professor went on by explaining in a kindly way. "Young miss is bad, very bad. She wants blood. And the blood she must have or die. My friend John and I have consulted, and we are about to perform what we call transfusion of blood, to transfer from full veins of one to the empty veins which pine for him. John was to give his blood, as he is the more young and strong than me." Here Arthur took my hand and wrung it hard in silence. "But now you are here, you are more good than us, old or young, who toil much in the world of thought. Our nerves are not so calm, and our blood so bright than yours, you silly American lumberjack." Arthur turned to him and said, "If only you knew how gladly I would die for her, you would understand." He stopped with a sort of choke in his voice. "Good boy," said Van Helsing. "In the not so far off you will be happy that you have done all for her you love. Come now and be silent. You shall kiss her once before it is done, but then you must go and you must leave at my sign. Say no word to Madame. You know how it is with her. There must be no shock. Any knowledge of this would be one. Come." We all went up to Lucy's room. Arthur, by direction, remained outside. Lucy turned her head and looked at us, but said nothing. She was not asleep, but she was simply too weak to make the effort. "Tell me about it." Her eyes spoke to us. That was all. Van Helsing took some things from his bag and laid them on a little table out of sight. Then he mixed a narcotic, and coming over to the bed said cheerily, "Now, little miss, here is your medicine. Drink it off like a good child. Drink it off like a good child. See, I lift you so that to swallow is easy, yes? She had made the effort with success. It astonished me how long the drug took to act. This, in fact, marked the extent of her weakness. The time seemed endless until sleep began to flicker in her eyelids. At last, however, the narcotic began to manifest its potency and she fell into a deep sleep. When the professor was satisfied, he called Arthur into the room and bade him strip off his coat. Then he added, "You may take that one little kiss whilst I bring over the table. Friend John, help to me." So neither of us looked whilst he bent over her. Van Helsing, turning to me, said, "He is so young and strong, and of blood so pure, that we need not defibrinate it." Good, good, I'm glad they're not going to defibrinate it. Then, with swiftness, but with absolute method, Van Helsing performed the operation. As the transfusion went on, something like life seemed to come back to poor Lucy's cheeks, and through Arthur's growing pallor, the joy of his face seemed absolutely to shine. After a bit, I began to grow anxious, for the loss of blood was telling on Arthur, strong man as he was. It gave me an idea of what a terrible strain Lucy's system must have undergone, that what weakened Arthur only partially restored her. Yes, she must have been sucked dry, really, mustn't she? She's a husk. She's an alabaster husk. But the professor's face was set, and he stood watch in hand, and with his eyes fixed now on the patient and now on Arthur, I could hear my own heart beat. "Presently," he said in a soft voice, "do not stir an instant. It is enough. You attend him. I will look to her." When all was over, I could see how much Arthur had weakened. Was weakened, I beg your pardon. God, that's my kebab. They've taken it back to the shop. I dressed the wound and took his arm to bring him away when Van Helsing spoke without turning round. The man seemed to have eyes in the back of his head. "The brave lover, I think, deserve another kiss, which he shall have presently." And as he had now finished his operation, he adjusted the pillow to the patient's head. Pillows, I find pillows so annoying. Pillows are either, you know, unlike Goldilocks, either they're too hard or too soft. There is nothing. Got a really hard pillow. It's like sleeping on a sort of weak old loaf of Hovis. It's hard, unforgiving. And another pillow, which is just sort of like sleeping on a, I don't know, crumpled J-cloth. Anyway, that's me. That's enough moaning. As he did so, the narrow black velvet band, which she seems always to wear round her throat, buckled with an old diamond buckle which her lover had given her, was dragged a little up and showed a red mark on her throat. Arthur did not notice it, but I could hear the deep hiss of indrawn breath, which is one of Van Helsing's ways of betraying emotion. He said nothing at the moment, but turned to me, saying, "Now take down our brave young lover, give him of the port wine, and let him lie down a while. He must go home and rest. Sleep much and eat much, that he may be recruited of what he has so given to his love. He must not stay here. Hold a moment. I take it, sir, that you are anxious of result. Then bring it with you, that in all ways the operation is successful. You have saved her life this time, and you can go home and rest easy in mind that all that can be is. I shall tell her all when she is well. She shall love you nonetheless for what you have done. Goodbye." When Arthur had gone, I went back to the room. Lucy was sleeping gently, but her breathing was stronger. I could see the counterpane move as her breast heaved. By the bedside sat Van Helsing looking at her intently. The velvet band again covered the red mark. I asked the professor in a whisper, "What do you make of that mark on her throat?"
"What do you make of it?"
"I've not examined it yet," I answered, and then and there proceeded to loose the band. Just over the external jugular vein, there were two punctures, not large, but not wholesome-looking. There was no sign of disease, but the edges were white and worn-looking, as if by some trituration. It at once occurred to me that this wound, or whatever it was, might be the means of that manifest loss of blood. Blimey, what a great deduction that is. But I abandoned the idea as soon as it formed, for such a thing could not be. The whole bed would have been drenched to a scarlet with the blood which the girl must have lost to leave such a pallor as she had before the transfusion.
"Well?" said Van Helsing.
"Well," said I can make nothing of it."
The professor stood up.
"I must go back to Amsterdam tonight," he said. "There are books and things there which I want. You remain here all night, and you must not let your sight pass from her."
"Shall I have a nurse?" I asked.
"We are the best nurses, you and I. You keep watch all night, see that she is well fed and that nothing disturbs her. A little glass of banana Nesquik will bring her back from the brink."
"You must not sleep all night.
Later on we can sleep, you and I. I shall be back as soon as possible, and then we may begin."
"May begin?" I said. "What on earth do you mean?"
"We shall see," he answered as he hurried out. He came back a moment later and put his head inside the door, and said with a warning finger held up, "Remember, she is your charge. If you leave her, and harm befall, you shall not sleep easy hereafter."
Well, that's a bit of a warning, and I wonder what he means. It's good that they recognised even in the late Victorian, early Edwardian era that banana Nesquik was curative and efficacious. Safe and effective, as I think they would call it today. But, so Van Helsing has performed a venesection on young Arthur Holmwood. Didn't even need fibrination or defibrination. I wonder if they worried too much about what type of blood they would pop in the other person, the recipient. I suppose they didn't. They didn't have to be O rhesus or O negative to receive someone else's blood. They just popped it in. And then if you had a sort of psychologically restorative port wine, because it's strong and it's the same colour as blood almost, then, yeah, that would sort you out. And if you died, then it was probably something to do with the bad fish cake you had in at the Savoy Grill, if the Savoy Grill did fish cakes, even bad ones, but I don't know. Interesting. Anyway, thanks for listening. And that was actually, I think, a complete chapter. No, it wasn't. It wasn't a complete chapter, but I think that will do because it was exhausting. Shall we leave it there?
Yeah, I think so. Fare thee well, my friends. Thanks for listening.